Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kevin Zeese of the group PopularResistance.org, who explains why the nation's labor and environmental movements are waging a determined campaign to block Fast Track and the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Kostas Paniatakis, professor of sociology at New York City College of Technology, who discusses what's at stake in current negotiations between Greece's Syriza government and Eurozone officials on the nation's access to bailout funds and demands for more austerity measures. And Sister Ardeth Plati, a 79-year-old Catholic nun and peace activist, who talks about her three compatriots whose conviction for sabotaging a U.S. nuclear facility were recently overturned by a federal appeals court. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In its new migration policy, the European Union is moving to take aggressive military action against Libyan-based smugglers and traffickers. EU officials have gone to the United Nations to win authorization to use force on Libyan territory and waterways to break up and impede the flow of tens of thousands of migrants heading toward Europe. At the same time, the European Commission is debating a new quota system for each EU member country to accept its share of 20,000 refugees over the next 2 years. The plan is backed by Germany and Sweden, who have accepted the bulk of recent asylum seekers. But the plan is opposed by Conservative Prime Ministers David Cameron of Britain and Hungary's Viktor Orban. According to the Guardian newspaper, military planning documents call for possible onshore operations in Libya, where most of the trafficker networks operate. The plans call for seizing the smugglers' assets, including boats used to transport migrants across the Mediterranean Sea. Libya's United Nations representative, Ibrahim Debashi, opposes the EU plan, while Philip Luther of Amnesty International warned that introducing measures to tackle smugglers without providing safe alternative routes will not solve the plight of migrants and refugees. In 2005, Canadian mining giant Kinross, with global operations in the U.S., Russia, and Ghana, took over the gold mine in Paracatu, Brazil. During a period of sky-high gold prices, Kinross invested nearly $2 billion in the mine, tripling production and making it the most productive gold mine in Brazil. The huge mine, which explodes dynamite over 150 times a day, has transformed the landscape. Toxic chemicals, including cyanide, are used to separate out gold powder in the processing plant. Arsenic is also a common byproduct of gold mining. In Paracatu, a kilogram of the carcinogen is released into the air and groundwater for each half gram of gold recovered. Former workers say Kinross company officials run their own intelligence unit to monitor the mine's critics and their political activity. A local source told the Guardian newspaper, "The main goal of the company's spies is to hide or repress any action, demonstration, or reference against the mining company or its interests." Worker advocates are praising new H-2B guest workers program rules issued by the U.S. Department of Labor and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Meanwhile, employers who rely on low-skilled guest workers have criticized the rules as flawed. The H-2B visa program brings foreign workers to fill vacancies in low-skilled, non-agricultural work. After working up to 10 months, guest workers are required to leave the United States. A new comprehensive federal rule on guest workers comes after the program was shut down for 2 weeks in March. The new regulations require each worker to receive a contract in a language they understand, guarantee workers three-quarters of the hours they were promised, and increased transparency in the recruitment process. The news magazine In These Times reports that the new rules also make getting H-2B workers' permits more difficult, which most worker advocates see as a good thing because it gives American workers a fair shot at the jobs. The guest worker program was created to help fill labor shortages, but under the recent system, the bar for proving a shortage was low. According to the Economic Policy Institute, unemployment rates in top H-2B industries are high and getting higher, signaling plenty of willing American workers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The battle in Congress over Trade Promotion Authority, also known as Fast Track, the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, and another European Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, TTIP, is in high gear. President Obama is pressuring lawmakers to pass Fast Track, which is a mechanism that forces Congress to vote on a trade agreement within 60 to 90 days of receiving it, with only limited debate and no amendments allowed. While Fast Track has been stalled in the U.S. Senate, it's expected to eventually pass there, with the real fight moving to the House of Representatives. There, an unlikely coalition of mostly Democrats and some Republicans are opposed to a free trade deal, citing a variety of reasons. Disagreement on the measure between President Obama and Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren has been very public and has at times turned ugly. Warren maintains that successive U.S. administrations have broken promises on trade agreement provisions that are designed to hold trading partners accountable for adhering to high labor, environmental, and human rights standards. Another controversial provision, called investor-state dispute settlement in both the TPP and TTIP, allows multinational corporations to challenge local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings, if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. Your reporter spoke with Kevin Zeese, longtime social justice activist and co-director of the group PopularResistance.org. Here he discusses the determined campaign being waged by labor, environmental, and civil society groups to block Fast Track and the proposed free trade agreements.
Where we're going to stop Fast Track is going to be in the House of Representatives. Right now, we have majority support. They are several dozen votes short of a majority in the House of passing Fast Track. And so that is where we have to really build our majority and protect our majority, is the U.S. House of Representatives. The place where Fast Track is right now is in the U.S. Senate. The Democrats say we have lots of amendments. There's about 12 to 16 Democrats who want to submit amendments. There are amendments from Republicans as well. We don't expect to stop in the Senate. The amendment process will be very important, though, because the amendment process will raise issues that will help us strengthen our case in the House. For example, one amendment that failed in the Finance Committee that's very popular is an amendment that would protect our law that favors buying American. That's a very popular law, and that is something that failed in the Senate to be protected in this Fast Track, and that would be a very strong argument in the House as well to get more people to support our view. Another issue is stopping currency manipulation. One of the challenges in trade is that countries can change the value of their currency, lower the value of the currency, make their products cheaper, and therefore they can export more, and that makes it hard for the United States to compete. And so that's an issue that also was rejected in the Senate Finance Committee and will be brought up and challenged and fought. And we'll see how that goes. That'll be another issue that will be very helpful to get more people on our side in the House. The game is the House. That's where the real fight is. We're seeing a massive opposition, right, left opposition, environmentalists, food advocates, GMO advocates. Almost every issue is represented, and we can win this if people mobilize and participate. And you can do it easily at stopfasttrack.com. It'll walk you through the process of what you can do to help.
Kevin, you just recently wrote an article that highlights the secrecy surrounding these TPP negotiations, focusing on a letter that Republican Senator Jeff Sessions recently wrote, a dear colleague letter that underscored all the facts that he's read about this trade bill that most of his colleagues don't know because they haven't read all the text of this proposed treaty.
Yeah, well, the administration's made it very hard even for elected officials to see this treaty. Initially, they didn't even allow it. They classified these documents as secrets, so only limited people can see it. And they've gradually loosened it up slightly. So now if you jump through the hoops, you can go to the basement of the Senate and into a special room, and you can read the TPP there, and you are not allowed to bring with you paper or pencil, cameras, phones, computers, anything to record what's in it, and you are told that if you divulge what you've read, you will be violating a criminal law and could face criminal prosecution. Only Senate staff with clearance are able to see it, and they can only see it with the senator, and the same is true in the House as well. And so very few senators have gone through that process. It's a pretty useless process. But Senator Jeff Sessions is one of the two Republicans who did. And he went in there and read it. And what he did that was unusual, that no one else who's read these agreements has done, is he told people what he read. And he did that in a five-page letter to all members of the Senate, both sides of the aisle. And that got leaked. And the thing he focused on that bothers him a lot is what he calls the living treaty provisions, which allows the members of the signers of the treaty, the countries that sign it, for their president or prime minister to agree to add additional countries or to change the agreement without review by their legislatures. And so Congress would approve the TPP, and then they could change it, and Congress would have no role. Once again, sovereignty comes up. This is a great slap in the face of the one of the three branches of government taking away their responsibility. That is kind of significant.
Kevin, just in closing here, with only about a minute left, most economists look at these free trade agreements and say they're very destructive to good-paying jobs, many manufacturing jobs here in the United States. But yet we have Democrats and Republicans in the White House pushing these free trade bills. Certainly Barack Obama, when he was running for the presidency, criticized NAFTA and the provisions there. But here he is pushing a pretty similar agenda. You look at this and you might assume that there is a permanent government in Washington that is pretty secret in nature. And I'm wondering, what is being exposed here with this bipartisan effort to push these free trade agreements, even though they're not good for the U.S. economy overall?
There are big business interests that continue, have a life of their own. No matter who's president, no matter who's in the Senate, they have access to them through their money and their wealth. They can promise jobs after they leave office. They can promise give board of director seats to their spouses, their children. They can, give gigantic campaign donations and major money for speeches and such. And so the corrupting influence is immense. But this is part of a much broader agenda of a global redesign of how we govern ourselves. This, I think, is maybe the central issue for debate in this century. You know, we went through periods of serfdom and monarchy. We've gone through periods of issues like major changes on those kinds of issues. We're now in this phase now. Are we going to see an increase in corporate serfdom for us, or are we going to take control of our own lives and end the power of corporations to dominate how we are governed? And I think this global redesign initiative is something that people should start to understand and review, because it is a shocking concept to reduce nation states, turn the UN into a hybrid corporate government institution, and really give corporations the power to make law that affects every aspect of our lives. We will become corporate serfs in this century if the people don't get organized and develop our own approach to how we put people and planet before profits.
That was Kevin Zeese, co-director of the group PopularResistance.org and co-host of the Clearing the Fog radio program. Find more news and commentary on the campaign to stop Fast Track and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Syriza Party, the coalition of the radical left, won a decisive victory in Greece's January national election on a pledge to challenge harsh Eurozone austerity measures imposed in exchange for a bailout of the battered Greek economy. Now negotiations are being conducted between Syriza's Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, and representatives of the European Commission, European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, collectively known as the Troika. Pressure is growing on Greece, which is fast running out of money, to make a deal before the end of May, as the government is due to make a payment of $1.67 billion to the International Monetary Fund by June 5th. If negotiators can't reach an agreement on Eurozone demands for more austerity measures and reforms, some $8 billion in bailout funds won't be released, which may cause the country to go into default. Speculation about default and the unknown consequences of Greece's possible exit from the Eurozone have hobbled the nation's fragile economy. For its part, the Syriza government faces tough choices on how to reach a compromise with Eurozone creditors without violating the party's campaign pledge to reverse some austerity measures and raise the minimum wage. Your reporter spoke with Kostas Panayiotakis, professor of sociology at New York City College of Technology, who talks about what's at stake in current negotiations between Greece's Syriza government and Eurozone officials, and concern in the European Union that if concessions are made to Greece, resistance to austerity policies could spread across Europe.
Syriza, basically, when it ran against austerity, it was running against the dominant strategy that has been used by European elites to deal with the current crisis. So as a result, it is seen as a threat, because if Syriza is successful in reversing austerity, then other countries, the people in other countries, might follow the example, and notably Spain, that has elections later this year, and where there is another leftist party similar in profile to Syriza. So this is seen as a threat by European elites, and that's why they're putting immense pressure on Syriza to continue the same policies. They're trying to make the economy scream, basically, by removing liquidity. So Syriza is now finding itself, in effect, continuing the austerity policy even before the negotiation has been concluded. And the pressure is such that their goal at this point seems to sort of ameliorate austerity rather than reverse it completely. So basically, what you have here is a determination by European economic and political elites to basically make it impossible for a democratically elected government to break with free market fundamentalism of the neoliberal paradigm that prevails in Europe and beyond. I mean, they are trying to force Greece to run budget surpluses at a time when unemployment is over 25%. It's crazy, and it's a program and a set of policies that has failed even by the admission of the International Monetary Fund, and yet they are trying to push Syriza to continue these failed policies.
Describe for our listeners the conditions in Greece, the economic conditions that led voters to put the Syriza party in power, given the high unemployment rates, a real kind of erosion of the social safety net in Greece in terms of medical care and unemployment and pensions. Maybe briefly describe for our listeners what the conditions are that really changed the political situation in Greece.
The consequences of the austerity policies that were imposed on Greece were, you know, socially and economically devastating. They can only be compared to the effects of the Great Depression on the U.S. The economy shrunk by 25%. Unemployment rate has skyrocketed to over 25%. It's over 50% for young people. Poverty has increased dramatically. The education system and hospitals, the healthcare system, have suffered by savage budget cuts. So there is a lot of poverty. It becomes more and more common to see people looking for food in the garbage. And the middle class, the Greek middle class, has been devastated. And of course, the Greek middle class was the backbone of the long-standing ruling parties in Greece, the socialists and the conservatives, who were resoundingly defeated in the election last January.
Lay out for us the growing political parties in Spain, Italy, and Portugal, some states that have been subject to Eurozone austerity measures, and the likelihood that they may take power and similarly challenge these austerity measures as Greece has in the coming months.
The most promising case, I think, is Podemos in Spain. It's a new party that grew out of the movement of the squares, the Indignados, in 2011. And at a similar time, around the same time, there was a movement in Greece as well, which helped to boost support for Syriza. So at some point earlier in the year, it looked like Podemos was the most popular party in Spain, according to polls. But most recent polls suggest that support for Podemos may have been subsiding a bit. So it looks like the political sort of scene in Spain will be drastically changed in the upcoming election. But it's not necessarily clear that as yet that Podemos will be as successful as Syriza and will be able to form a government. So this remains to be seen. The problem is that, you know, there has to be an agreement between the Europeans and the Syriza government probably before any of these elections in the coming months. So the sequence is very important, because if an agreement comes before these elections and this agreement involves basically Syriza capitulating, this will basically affect the outcome of other elections and discourage people from voting other anti-austerity parties in other countries. And I think that's part of the motivation of the Europeans to take the hard line they've been taking so far.
That was Kostas Paniatakis, professor of sociology at New York City College of Technology at the City University of New York. Find more perspectives on the Greek Eurozone negotiations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Three peace activists who walked onto a U.S. nuclear weapons site in 2012 have been freed from prison after their convictions for sabotage were overturned by an appeals court. The group, known as Transform Now Plowshares, are part of the Plowshares movement, which has organized more than 100 nonviolent direct actions against war since 1980. The three activists released included Michael Wally, Greg Borche Obed, and an 85-year-old nun, Sister Megan Rice, who broke into the Y-12 nuclear facility at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. There they painted peace slogans and threw blood on the walls, revealing major security flaws at the facility, which processes uranium for hydrogen bombs. They were convicted of depredation of government property and sabotage. The men were originally sentenced to 5 years in prison, while Sister Megan was sentenced to almost 3 years. After the three had served 2 years in prison, a federal appeals court on May 8th threw out the sabotage conviction, ruling that the prosecution failed to prove the three intended to injure the national defense. All three were released almost immediately and are free pending their sentencing on the lesser charge. Defense lawyers say they've served more time than that charge originally brought. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sister Ardeth Platy, a 79-year-old Catholic nun who's participated in several Plowshares actions and says she has no idea how much time she spent in prison as a result, but estimates 8 or 9 years. Here she describes the Plowshares philosophy that leads activists like her to participate in civil disobedience actions that risk arrest and prison time.
We do Plowshare actions after the statement from Isaiah and Micah, "They shall hammer their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against another nation, nor shall they train for war anymore." So we base our actions, our plowshare actions, that we would rather have food production through plowshares rather than war making and spears and what now is nuclear weapons and conventional weapons that massively kill people. These plowshare actions, and there have been more than 100 now, are nonviolent civil resistance symbolic actions. And what they do is uphold the laws of the land. Right now at the United Nations, there is the review of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty that we have signed, and many other nations, all but two or three nations, have signed that treaty. And it was signed in 1970. So the United States and other nuclear weapon nations committed to dismantling, disarming, stopping all nuclear weapons. So right now it's being reviewed again in the United Nations. The grassroots movement of Plowshares people do these symbolic actions to remind the governments that they have a treaty to uphold, and that as long as they do not disarm and dismantle these weapons, they are committing criminal actions, because every treaty is the law of the land. Every treaty that we sign is under the Supremacy Clause of the United States government.
I understand that you're not only comrades in Plowshares, but you're a close personal friend of Sister Megan. Have you been able to visit her?
No, when we are felons, we are not permitted to visit other prisons. So as a felon, I have been unable to get into prisons for visits. We have been communicating very frequently, and, you know, Sister Megan is keeping to the cause. That cause is the disarmament of nuclear weapons, taking them off high trigger alert, stop the targeting of them, stop the threatening to use them, which is totally illegal under the International Court of Justice. So Sister Megan, Greg, and Michael have been very faithful to this quest. We are, of course, rejoicing and celebrating that the judges, we were at the hearing in Cincinnati, that these judges sought fit to study the law and to make sure that they are released for new sentencing. Now, our commitment would be that none of the following actions should be charged based on the fact that they're stopping a crime from happening. So whatever they had to do, if, for example, a building were burning and we know that the people inside are in danger, you know, we would enter in to that site in order to stop anyone from being injured. We feel the same way regarding nuclear weapons, that sometimes you have to enter into the site. You have to say loudly and clearly, there is a crime going on at this site. Enriched uranium is now building secondaries. You are expanding the site. And why would you do this when you know under the law we have a commitment to dismantle, disarm all nuclear weapons in this nation?
Can you say what's going to happen next?
A resentencing would be for depredation of government property. However, they could drop that also in court, because they've already served more time than that charge actually occasions. Okay. They should be out on their own recognizance. They're all nonviolent, loving people who serve the poorest. And, you know, we hope they can get back to their missions to do that.
That was Catholic nun Sister Ardeth Plati, a member of the Plowshares movement and a compatriot of the three anti-war activists just released from prison. Find more news on the Plowshares movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.